I'm really curious about your work with education, and we've been talking a lot in our kind of weekly discussion groups about applications of contemplative practice, engaged Buddhism as a kind of a general but very diverse category. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about how you apply Buddhism within a kind of an educational framework.
Yeah, it's a really big topic. I'll try and be very succinct as I can. I'm working with three schools, the two schools that Ravi mentioned, and then one in Chiang Mai. And the philosophy, the Buddhist philosophy of education, as it were, is based on applying the threefold training of sila, samadhi, and panya, which I don't know if you're familiar with that. That's sort of telescoping the eightfold path into a training of sila and then samadhi, panya. I found that the difficulty with using that terminology in the educational sphere is that many parents are wary of that approach because it sounds too much like a seminary, or that their children might end up wanting to become monks and nuns, which is not what most parents want for their kids. And that's not the idea of the school or this system either. So I look through the Buddhist discourses looking for another way of expressing these same principles. And I came across a teaching what's called the four pavana, that's Bhavana, or kinds of four kinds of development, which is basically just recasting the same principle, but it's expressed as an education or a development of the relationship of the human being to the material world, and secondly, the relationship of the human being to the social world, and then the third is the education of the heart and the emotions, and the fourth, the education of the wisdom faculty. And I found that that provided a more modern way of talking, which wouldn't lead it to be a very kind of narrow or elitist kind of approach, which would put off many people who are, let's say, they're Buddhist, but they're not sort of really devoted meditators or practitioners. And so wanting to make clear that there's no real rift between an approach to education which is based upon Buddhist principles and the more conventional education, but that it's one which fills in the gaps that conventional education has allowed to manifest, and particularly in the attention given to the heart and the emotional development of children. And using that four-fold framework, then the subjects which are compulsory through Thai law can be integrated within that. And so the sciences would go into, most of the sciences into the relationship between the human being and the material world. So from that basis, then further develop that. So in the first of those four categories, the development of the relationship between the human being and the material world, the first would be the relationship of human being and their physical body. So that would include things like nutrition or sex education and biology and sports, and then expanding to relationship to those elements of the material world with which we are most familiar, which we have to do with in every day, and with technology and possessions and money and so on. And then the outer ring, outer sphere would be the environment. So those would be like the three main headings of that first category. And then the second category is using wise use of precepts and conventions and agreements in order to create the optimum conditions for growth in Dhamma. Emphasis on development of communication skills, and then emphasis on creating an interest and skills in contributing to the wider society. And then so those are the two outer, we have these kind of phrases like two outer, two inner. So those are the two outer categories. And the two inner would be, particularly teaching children how to protect their minds against the unwholesome dhammas of anxiety and depression, stress and so on, and how to develop wholesome qualities of mindfulness and kindness and compassion and self-motivation and patience and so on. And then the fourth category, the wisdom category, is starting off with basic critical and creative thinking skills and going on to some more specific Buddhist contemplations. So that's the overall structure. But it's not just what's being taught, but it's the whole idea of the school as being a school of learners. So there are texts in which the Buddha refers to the arahant, or the fully enlightened human being, as a graduate. So the idea is that an enlightened person is the person who's graduated from the Buddha's education, and that everyone else except for arahants are all in need of education, so we're all learners. So there's this idea of the children are one learning community, the parents are a learning community, and the teachers are a learning community, and that we should all seek to learn from each other. And I could go on about this for a long time. Just one more point is the key concept is of good friendship. And so that the teacher in the Theravada is not like a guru or a god figure. He's like the best friend that you could possibly imagine. That's the goal. That's the idea of a teacher. And trying to create a community based upon principles of good friendship. And that's in very much part of the way the school is run. So the Buddhist influence, not solely in terms of subject matter, but also in the way that we live together and learn together.
Thank you very much.
Sorry. Let me just see if I can.
Yeah, and to just add, I had the opportunity to visit the school when I was in Thailand this past summer, and it's quite a nice, or the Panyapratip school, and it's quite a nice place. So I guess if any of you are interested in this kind of education, or just education in general, perhaps consider volunteering or getting involved with the school.
Yeah, anybody wants coming to Thailand, you're very welcome to come and visit, or even to come and stay and participate in the life of the school for a time.
I have a question on balancing focus on internal versus external, because I know some people have the conception that Buddhism is kind of an isolated practice where one focuses on the self rather than focusing outside on societal issues. And then on the flip side, people who focus too much on societal issues might burn out and tear themselves out. So I'm wondering what you think the approach would be to strike the perfect balance between the two.
Yeah, well, I think most people who have any done any reading or any contact with Buddhism will be familiar with the word Dhamma or Dhamma. But at the time of the Buddha, the phrase that was used most commonly was Dhamma Vinaya. And the Vinaya's kind of been lost. But the Vinaya means all the ways in which we seek to construct the most conducive environment for everyone to grow in the Dhamma. So the Vinaya is taken to its most sophisticated level in the rules and that govern the life of the bhikkhus, because this was a society within a society that the Buddha created himself and could structure himself. But it's also an idea that applies to lay society, and the idea of how we can create laws and regulations and conventions and customs and agreements in families, in societies, in which we can support the growth in Dhamma. So I think that it's been as being like exclusively or overly focused on the individual is much more a comment on the transmission of how Buddhism has been transmitted to the West and the aspects of Buddhism that have been taken up by people in the West, rather than the original vision of the Buddha, or as you can still find it practiced and experienced in some parts of Southeast Asia to this day, or speaking about the Theravada school. Well, I think that last few years I've been going to China quite a lot and speaking with Mahayana Buddhists and monastics in China about this, how far to go out to relieve suffering in the world, and often the Mahayana Buddhist friends will say, there is this kind of image of the Theravada Buddhists as kind of selfish and only involved in their own welfare. So it is a idea or a perception that's within Buddhist communities also. So I would say all that I can say is that as we understand it, the Buddha said that self-development and development of the community have to go hand in hand, and that they mutually reinforce each other, and that if you want to contribute to your community, you have to know how to look after your own mind. Because I'm sure you've met people who get really passionate about doing something about injustice in society or some environmental issues or whatever, and throw themselves into it and then completely burn out within a year or two. And so they're unable to sustain that kind of commitment over a long period. Whereas if someone is also looking after their heart, training their heart, and being mindful and patient, and then they have the resources to be able to deal with all the challenges of helping others in a way that prevent them from getting burnt out. Also, I think that a big problem with groups of well-meaning individuals in NGOs or in any charitable foundation tend to be attachment to views and opinions, and everyone gets very particularly passionate, when there's the idea, I'm right, and this isn't just for me, this is for everybody, this is for the country or for the planet, and everything becomes turned up to 11. And having that meditative perspective on views and opinions and how attachment works and how poisonous it is, I think that also can help, can mean a much more constructive engagement with others, and again to be helping in long term rather than just a short-term burst of enthusiasm.
Thank you. That was very insightful.
And I guess I have a follow-up to that, if that's okay. Yeah, we read your text on love in preparation for this session. And yeah, you talked a bit about how kind of passion for a cause or a country or something like that can like give us meaning and like what you described just now, but it can also kind of burn us out and rob us of wisdom. And I guess we've been talking in our discussions about a lot of current events, specifically what's happening in the United States and what's happened as a result of coronavirus, kind of these various injustices. And I guess I was wondering when these emotional reactions are so strong and we feel so strongly about the issue, how can we better see the other side or kind of avoid having these one-sided perceptions of especially when we're like really passionate and inflamed by something that we see is wrong in the world?
Yeah, I mean, this is I think again our ability to do that is enhanced by meditation practices in which we're learning to take a step back from views, opinions, thoughts, emotions, and being aware of just this flow without an owner. And so that kind of less identification with our own views and ideas and beliefs and fears enables us to open ourselves up to other opinions and views, and also to see them as being selfless, as not to make sort of demonic figures out of demonic behaviors, you know, not to solidify that thing and create this world of bad people, and because that can be very depressing apart from anything else. But I think that you know, it's very common that we tend to make straw men and look for the weakest and the most despicable kinds of expressions of views and beliefs that we disagree with, and that it's good to try and say, well, you know, who is the most intelligent and the most articulate person who expresses the kind of views that I disagree with, and really listen to them and say, you know, or something that you find, just how could anybody possibly think that, or you know, then you think, but then that is it's a really good challenge to think, how would it be possible to consider that as a rational and reasonable view or action? Because in many cases those people do feel that what they're doing is rational and reasonable, and how do you get to that point, and what are the premises, the beliefs that you take on board and which will make that kind of view seem reasonable? Because it's usually within the context of a larger belief system. And I think that when you can deconstruct these things and see them in terms of thoughts and ideas which are based upon beliefs which are based upon, and then it just takes a lot of the kind of the poison out of it when you see people as you say, behaving in these terrible ways, and to see the fear and the anger and the just the fact that someone can take on a false idea or like a poisonous belief, maybe when they're young, and then it just becomes part of them, and then it becomes very almost impossible for them to stand outside of that and even to consider the possibility that it could be wrong. And I think as meditators, as practitioners, you know, then if we tend towards that side, that, you know, sense of arrogance, and, you know, always saying, well, maybe I could be wrong. If you're someone who's very insecure and lacking any self-confidence, then maybe you need the mantra, maybe I'm right. But just finding that kind of balance between that sense of being right and just seeing that, yeah, that's probably a major cause of conflicts, you know, the sense of being right. And in fact, some years ago, I don't know if you ever, I'm afraid I can't remember the name of the book, but some scientists had, cognitive scientists, I guess, had isolated a particular area of the brain, which is associated with absolutely unshakable confidence or belief in something. And as I remember, there was a man in Australia who's absolutely 100% convinced he's dead. He participates in study sessions at the university, and you just can't argue him out of this belief that he's dead in any logical way, because he can always get around it. Yeah, I mean, this is true. You know, most people, or almost everybody who's dead, they're not breathing anymore. And you know, but this is just why it's just so weird. You know, like I'm dead, but like I can breathe and I can talk to you. And I just know. I mean, I know. So that I found absolutely fascinating that, someone who had a car accident and then has somehow affected this particular area of the brain suddenly had this incredibly unshakable confidence in the weirdest thing, I think in any way of looking and reflecting on things that just releases or reduces that sense of, you know, this is a person who is a bad person or is it. And there are various ways of looking and reflecting and to do that. And I think that's the only way that dialogue ever takes place, when we can identify and perhaps even allow others to recognize commonalities. It may be a cliche, but I think in the end that's the way that it works, you know, identifying and really putting effort into emphasizing commonalities between us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ajahn Dayasharo. I'm wondering if you could share a bit with us about your path as a teenager. What were your questions when you went out seeking? And did you have much exposure to Buddhism before? What other spiritual paths did you explore? And what was that like for you?
Yeah, I had asthma from the age of, like, I think from 18 months until I was 14. So I was always kind of sickly and at home a lot. So I read a lot. So I became a real bookworm, and probably much more bookish than if I'd gone to school. And so I was like to be alone. I like to read a lot. And so I had quite a questioning mind. And I just couldn't relate to Christianity. It made no sense to me at all. I just couldn't get on with it. And so I assumed that religion meant believing in things. And I didn't think that you needed to believe in things to, religious dogmas in order to live life. But then when I was, I think about 13, 14, I got this question, like, what's a good way to live, or what's the best way to live your life as a human being? And that seemed to me to open up a whole number of other questions, like, is that even a reasonable question? You know, we can talk, you know, let's say, compare two different cars, and we can say, oh, this is a superior car because it goes faster, because it's safer, because it's more comfortable, because it's more attractive. So we have all these different criteria to distinguish between material objects. But can we do that with a life and say, this is a better life than that life? And if so, what are the criteria for doing that? So this was what the other area was, why is the world such a mess? Why is there so much suffering in the world? Why is there so much injustice? Does it have to be like this? And if it doesn't have to be like this, what is your responsibility in a human being to make it better than what it is right now? So these were the two questions. I'm probably expressing them with more articulately than I did at that age, but those were the two things that were really in my mind a lot at school. And I'd also always had this absolute fascination with India from when I was small, anything to do with India. And then I saw this photograph of a yogi, you know, sitting in the ocean. It was so cool. And then I read Siddhartha and Hermann Hesse books, and then there was a movie. I don't know if you ever saw that movie of Siddhartha. Have you ever seen that? It's a German movie. But the first scene is like this lush, luxuriant Indian scene, and then you hear this sound Om Om, and there's the young Siddhartha sitting samadhi, and this, I got to do this. The other thing was, I was living in a small kind of provincial town, and I was constantly looking for a peer group. I always, I was always a bit, not quite fitting in with everybody else. And it seemed to me the only group that I had any kind of sense of connection with was the hippies. And so everything all came together with like the love for adventure and to test myself and to learn about life and to, with this, the hippie trail to India. So after I finished high school, I worked in a building site and in a warehouse and made some money and then set off overland to India. And I had many adventures and I was altogether in India for a year and visited different ashrams and was in Bodh Gaya for a while and when I went to McLeod Ganj, where the Tibetan community is, I had hepatitis and I just wasn't up to it really. And also I have this, have you ever heard of aphantasia? Do you know what that is? It's only had a name for a few years now, but it means where your brain is completely incapable of creating images and colors. So I have zero imagery in my brain. And it's people just starting to talk about this now. You know, it's just kind of like a new thing. You can look it up on Wikipedia, aphantasia. So this was a huge obstacle to Tibetan Buddhism and visualization. I can't do this. You know, so I was very attracted to the straightforwardness and the simplicity of Theravada Buddhism. So eventually, almost 2 years later, I got back to England and I got a bit lost and one thing to another, I went on a meditation retreat and the teacher had been a monk in Thailand and in his Dhamma talks, he would talk about the time that he was a monk and I thought, well, that's exactly what I've been looking for the past 2 years or more, and thought, yeah, obviously this is exactly what I need to be doing. So that led me to come to Thailand. I think just to, well, I left out an important thing earlier. The first book I came across on Buddhism was The Way of Zen by Alan Watts, and And many of the monks that I know and people of my generation, you know, have a great deal of gratitude to Alan Watts because his books were really instrumental in inspiring many people to begin spiritual path. And I remember just reading the first couple of pages of that book sitting on a park bench in Cambridge and just absolutely, yeah, just no question, this is it, you know. And it wasn't like this is a kind of exotic Asian philosophy. It was just like absolute common sense, you know. There's just no doubt about it. Yeah, that's kind of just a potted version.
Thank you very much.
I was wondering if you could comment more on the student-teacher relationship, either in Buddhism in general or in the Theravada tradition in particular.
Yeah, it's sort of it's a follow-on point from the previous question, in that apart from my realization, I wouldn't be able to really develop any of the meditations based on visualization. A more substantial doubt I had about Tibetan Buddhism was the relationship between the teacher and student, and how the teacher is considered to be the guru or sort of the living Buddha, and that kind of absolute devotion to an unconditional devotion to a teacher. I found that rather uninspiring and dangerous. It seemed to me to open up the possibility for all kinds of corruption, and I wondered whether I would be willing to give myself to that kind of a structure. And so what particularly attracted me to Buddhist monastic, Theravada monastic order, is that the Vinaya discipline applies to all monks, including fully enlightened arahants. There are no exceptions. There's not this idea that you reach a certain level and you don't have to do all this stuff anymore. You don't have to keep all these rules anymore because your mind is free, and whatever you do is per se enlightened behavior, and it shouldn't be held up to the norms of everyday behavior. You know, you're something else and above that now. What I liked is that in this tradition, then the teachers keep all the rules, even if they don't personally need to do that, but in order to be a good example to younger monks. Now, if you're a young monk and, you know, you start, a lot of the rules are really kind of irritating and you think, I don't really need to do this, you know, what difference does this make ultimately? And it's sort of the way your mind works. And then, you know, if you've got the teacher, and then when you get to that level, you don't have to do it anymore. So maybe I'm at that level already, and maybe I'm just, you know, that you can teach yourself a lot. But then when you see a teacher who keeps his rules, with great, very, you know, with real scrupulosity and really carefully, and then you think, well, if he keeps it, then, you know, what possible excuse can I have for not doing that? So that's a protection for young monks, and one of the rules for a new monk is that if he sees his teacher misbehaving, he has a duty to, with great respect, to admonish or to express his disease at what he's seeing. So there are kind of checks and balances built into the monastic, the hierarchical monastic system by the Buddha to prevent those in power from taking advantage of those under their guidance. And I was very impressed with this, and I felt that it created a system which, while not absolutely kind of bulletproof, there'll always be some corruption, but as far as possible was set up in a way to minimize or to prevent that whenever it was possible. And so over the years, I would say over the past 40 years, there have been so many of scandals in Buddhist and spiritual communities because of this lack of clarity about the relationship between students and teachers. And so for a monk, for instance, we're not allowed to be alone in a room with a woman or to speak more than your absolute minimum number of words without another man present. So that these are, there are all kinds of rules which are meant to prevent even the possibility of gossip or malicious, malevolent kind of slanders that have to be very, very careful to maintain the integrity of that connection between, particularly, you know, in a sort of heterosexual sense, between male monastics and female teachers. But whenever, I mean, a spiritual teacher is someone who has that kind of power and charisma, and it can be very intoxicating for new students particularly, and that's why spiritual teachers need a very clear-cut moral standard to prevent that relationship from being distorted or corrupted. And the same would work for a female teacher and a male student, I'm sure.
Thank you.
So, maybe just to add, to return to something that mentioned before, is the idea of in Theravada of the teacher is of what we call the Kalyana Mitta, or is the good friend. So it's like the best possible friend, is someone who keeps you from doing stupid things and gives you guidance and, you know, when you're about to lose it, and then cheers you up and encourages you when you're discouraged, and shares the knowledge and understanding with you, and is basically your spiritual welfare is his or her number one concern. That would be the idea of the teacher.
Hi, thank you. Would you be able to expand a little bit on what type of a friend Ajahn Chah was?
Yeah, for me, he fulfilled all of the criteria for the spiritual friend. So there are various levels, and so in everyday life, you know, the Buddhist idea is that we will strive to be good friend or Kalyana Mitta to those around us, but in different ways. So to try to be a good friend to our parents, to be a good friend to our spouses and girlfriends and boyfriends and our colleagues and so on. But in that sort of special or most elevated form of the good friend or the Kalyana Mitta, the Buddha spoke of seven characteristics. And I feel that Ajahn Chah, at least for me, fulfilled all of those. So the first is that the Kalyana Mitta just gives rise to feelings of great love and affection in the student. And with Ajahn Chah, you know, we used to go around to his cottage and sit, and he'd tell stories or he'd teach us or tell us off, and he'd be there to like 11, 12, and you have to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, so, and unless he to drive you away, you know, you wouldn't go back to your hut. You just wanted to be there and be with him and massage him or fan him or just sit and listen and be in his presence. So there is that, you know, that's the most kind of guru-like quality, you know, just that he inspires that sense of love and affection. Secondly is that he inspires respect. And that's the balance to the kind of the affection. There's that sense of respect and reticence around him, and Ajahn Chah is to inspire. I mean, I'm somebody who quite, you know, I traveled around the world. I left home when I was 17, and I had all kinds of adventures, and never really, I guess it's kind of the recklessness of youth, but I could say never afraid of anybody or anything that I can recall. And I met Ajahn Chah and I felt afraid of him. So this is kind of weird kind of thing. You have this kind of love and affection and then fear. It's not like he's trying to consciously inspire fear, but it's a fear, like you say, like if you were to come across like a lion in the middle of the forest, you know, there's a sense of awe and respect. And through his life and his practice and his integrity of his practice and the way he lived his life as a monk, you know, you just feel this great sense of respect. And then the third element is that you feel that you become better through being with him. You feel that your defilements become exposed and become weaker. And then you feel inspired to emulate him, and you can feel that the virtues within you are growing through being close to him or receiving his teachings. Fourth is that the Kalyana Mitta is a great patience and endurance with his students. So, you know, students can get they can be stubborn and opinionated, or they can be very clingy and they want to attach, or they want to sort of compete for your attention and so on. And so teachers have to be very, very patient with their students' foibles and shortcomings and defilements. I thought Ajahn Chah really had that quality to a great extent. Then he's someone who can express the Dhamma in a way that is appropriate to each individual, each group of person. There's some kind of a fixed way of talking, but one which takes into account the background, the spiritual maturity, the needs of each person that he speaks to or teaches, and is someone who can express the most profound principles of Dhamma in a very clear and easily understandable way, but one in which that clarity and ease is not the result of like dumbing it down or oversimplifying it, but a genuine translation of something which is very subtle into similes and metaphors and language that an audience can easily grasp. And the seventh quality of the Kalyana Mitra is he never leads his students astray. He never has any kind of personal agenda. I want to be powerful and famous and to take advantage of the students in any way or form. So those are the seven qualities of the Kalyana Mitra on the level of the spiritual teacher, which are laid down by the Buddha in the discourses. He inspires love, respect, emulation. He lifts people up. He's patient. He's a skilled communicator. He knows how to express the Dhamma, the profound Dhamma, in ways that are easily understandable. He never takes advantage of his students. So that's pretty sums up Ajahn Chah for me in those qualities. So.
Thank you.
I see that we're running close to the end of our time together, but maybe we have time for one more question.
Sure.
So, you've talked a lot about the qualities of a great teacher. I'd like to hear some more about the qualities you think are important for great students.
Yeah, good.
And also the importance of finding a great teacher.
First of all, there aren't that many great teachers around. And even if there are, even if you have the great good fortune and accumulated merit to find a great teacher, it's not always the best thing for you. Sometimes great teachers tend to be famous and they have a lot of people around them, and there can be a lot of pettiness and competition. And so it's not like you find the great teacher and now that's it, you know, you're on the way. It can or cannot be the case. And making that I've been in Thailand for 40 years now, and I've just seen so many people on this quest for a perfect teacher, and then they end up, you know, completely discouraged, or wherever they go, there's, you know, this fault-finding mind, and they're always disappointed in some area or some aspect, if not the teacher, then of the place, the monastery, or of the people around the teacher. And so as an attitude, you know, that I need a great teacher, I'm not really in support of that. I mean, if you do, then great, but not necessarily great either. What I think is important is a teacher where, as I mentioned just now, as you feel that there's progress being made, that the greed and hatred and confusion and doubt and jealousies and all these kind of negative mental states are over a period of time waning. You know, it's not like a day on day thing or even a week on week thing, but you can see like a trend over over a period of time, and that the wholesome dhammas of mindfulness and clear comprehension and effort and patience and so on, loving kindness and compassion are on the increase. And you could say that, yeah, if it wasn't for this teacher, then I can't see that happening. So it's someone who's further ahead on the path, and that you have that kind of connection with him, that you find that your practice develops. I think that's a more, in this day and age, that's a more practical level. The other thing is we do have this incredible advantage of technology, where now you can listen and watch great teachers from around, and have it, whether it's inspiration or whether it's information. You know, students have that access that would have been a dream, you know, for monks and meditators for the last 2,000 years, you know, to be able to listen and watch. Yeah, the great masters in a way that we can today. It's unbelievable. In terms of student, then patience and consistency, I think, is probably key. Often it's a trap is to just to really go on a retreat or something and really put in sort of a heroic effort for 10 days or even more, and then let it sort of all fritter away, and then go back and do another retreat, and let that fritters away. And then in the end, you sort of lose your confidence in the practice. And just maintaining a steady practice, day in, day out, that's in the long term, that's really important. And maintaining that interest in learning from whatever happens in your life, you know, it's all there to be learnt from. So that stance and that attitude of the student in every area of life, you know, learning how to be a human being, learning how to be a man, or learning how to be a a son, or how to be a boyfriend or a husband or a father. You know, there's so many things, and just looking at those things as like lifetime tasks that we're learning. But most important is commitment to learning the nature of the body and mind, and really understanding how the mind works, how the body works, how they affect each other, and that training and education of our thoughts and feelings and emotions, that's like the heart of the practice. And the more you look, then the more you see. And the classroom, if you like, is the present moment. So it's not like you're in the present moment and that's it. Now you're a spiritual adept, but the present moment is the environment, is the classroom in which you can do the work. So unless you can learn how to be in that classroom of the present moment, then there's nothing really profound taking place. So a lot of meditation practices are just learning that skill and that ability just to be in the present moment for a considerable length of time, because that's when you really start to penetrate into the nature of things and to extract all the sort of wrong ideas and assumptions and attachments that we've accumulated over many, many lifetimes. So I say, don't expect to be inspired all the time or think that there's something wrong when you're not inspired, because inspiration is also, it's a conditioned phenomena. You know, we can't be, even monks can be inspired all the time. But if you are struggling, don't always look outside for inspiration from teachers and teachings. But if you can develop that skill of reflection and contemplation in such a way that you can inspire yourself, then you have an incredible resource. You know, that developing that skill of inner motivation, whether it's for in your working life, your academic life, your working life, or your spiritual life. You know, this is how I feel right now. You know, not how I should feel, but this is how it is. And what can I do about that? You know, so you're just humbly accepting this is the raw materials that I've got right now, and what's the best that I can do with them. That would be my advice. There's I don't know if you ever read this story or heard the story about Einstein. So I tell this to school children. So Einstein, and the story anyway, is that he went to some big conference. So this is towards the end of his life, you know, where he's got that very distinctive appearance. But supposedly someone comes up to him at the conference and said, "Who are you?" Rather than saying, "I'm Albert Einstein, how could you not recognize me? And I've got 2 Nobel Prizes," and so on, he says, "Oh, I'm a student of physics." I think that captures that attitude really, really beautifully. You know, even like a world-renowned scientist can achieve all the accolades and fame and fortune, and yet he considers himself a student of physics. And I think to sustain that kind of perception of oneself is really helpful.
Okay. Well, thank you so much on behalf of, I think, all of us and the Buddhist community at Stanford. Thank you so much for coming to speak with us and lead a meditation. And also thank you to the Host Center of Buddhist Studies for co-sponsoring this event. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, this is my first time, so I've got to learn how to do this. It's and adapt to the new normal, and I hope I'll get a bit more fluent as I do it more often. Yeah, so it's midnight here. I think maybe time for me to go and have a rest. So I wish you all the best in your practice, and may you be well, happy, and may all the negative mental states in your heart wither away and die, and may all the positive mental states grow and flourish, and maybe we can see each other again sometime.